Welcome to You Don't Even Like This Band, a podcast about bands you probably don't even like.
We hope you don't know this one.
With your hosts, Adam Todd Brown, Andy Sell, and Travis Clark.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Fleetwood Mac season of You Don't Even Like This Band, a.k.a. Poddannon, a.k.a. Monday Morning Podcast. Fuck, I'm not doing good at this.
Wow, this time. That was quick.
Podcasts are hard to find.
Pod slide.
I like that.
Pod slide, yeah.
Over my pod?
Over my pod? Prove your pod?
Ooh. Pod your love.
Pod a little bit closer.
Yeah.
Yeah. We got it. We got a
Bermuda
lot of new entries.
Pod angle.
Sugar potty. Wait, that's not.
Ew. Oh my God.
That's not. Nope.
I don't like those.
No.
Way that sounds at all.
All right, Andy. I deeply regret you saying that.
Oh, that's a callback to the outtakes, everybody.
I deeply regret saying it.
I'm Adam Todd Brown. I don't think we introduced ourselves.
We did not.
Well, I'm Adam Todd Brown.
I'm remaining Travis fucking Clark.
And who are you?
I'm Andy Sell. Your middle name is...
Andy! Okay. Andy, you missed an outing with me and your mother, father. We went out and we saw Stephen Earle play some of his songs. And we don't know why you couldn't come with us. And you never call, you never write, you never come out when we do outings to see music. Why, Andy?
We bought you a t-shirt, Andy.
I appreciate the t-shirt. Thank you. I'm really excited about it. Mm. Really quick, I wanted to pitch you on this. I have an idea for $1 million merch idea.
Okay.
A coffee mug that says you don't even like coffee.
I question the revenue that you think that will generate.
Millions, Travis. It's $1 million merch idea. You watch it. The Discord's going to blow up after this.
I think we
everyone's
going to
be like, I want that coffee mug.
I think we need to grow a little bit as a podcast first.
Millions, Adam. We charge $700 per mug.
Here's what I think. I think we take your idea, we just tweak it a little bit. It's a coffee mug that says, you don't even like Andy Sell, and we sell that.
Yeah. That would sell more, I think, actually. You could sell that to my family.
So we are talking about the end of the Bob Welch era and the beginning of the Stevie Nicks, Lindsey Buckingham era. When we left off, the band had just wrestled control of their name back from their rogue manager and his band. What were they called? Air Shaft or something like that? I don't even remember now. Curved Air, I think it was.
Curved Air. Yeah, it sounded like an early 80s science fiction novel title.
They released a diss track about Mick Fleetwood because he didn't want to join their sham Fleetwood Mac reunion.
They reached the level where you fight your evil mirror self.
Yeah.
Yeah, they released a song called You Don't Even Like This Band.
And so that all worked out in Fleetwood Mac's favor eventually. And so we're gonna talk about the years after that. As far as sources, we are still knee-deep in Mick Fleetwood's book, which is called Play On, Now Then, and Fleetwood Mac.
We are percussion balls deep.
We sure are.
We are all wearing our percussion vests.
Yeah, we are
and
still
doing a performance. Yeah.
We are still slapping that vest. This time around, we're adding a couple extra sources. Go ahead, Andy. Go for
merch
Andy.
$1 million merch idea, vests. That say, you don't even slap this vest.
I think it should say, you don't even like this vest, is what it should say on it.
Yeah, Andy is our new promotion coordinator.
<They're hired. laughs> $1 million ideas.
$1 million salary, more like it. These are all winners.
I'll take it.
I'm joking. So,
damn.
This time around, we are adding a couple more books to the mix. Case in point, Gold Dust Woman, the biography of Stevie Nicks by Steven Davis. Mm. Also, Playing in the Rain, Lindsey Buckingham and Fleetwood Mac by Tyler Martin Senhall.
Oh, TMS.
With yeah, the hot TMS. Fire. Yeah. Neither of those two have ever written a book.
Wait,
who are they?
Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham, I mean, not the authors of the books. I'm sure it's like, they've written plenty of books. But
I thought you were saying these authors had never, I was going to be like, including these?
Yeah, I was like, that's amazing. Are they just like AI-generated books and they made up names to put on them?
I think Tucker Max ghost wrote these books. It's another reference to the outtakes, everybody. But Google it. You might figure out what we're talking about.
I've had-ish with all these outtakes.
What the hell?
Sorry. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, we should do a Tiffany podcast one season. She'd be interesting.
Oh. Oh, fuck yeah. I think we're alone now.
I think we're podcasting now.
There we go.
I think we can pod now.
Yeah.
The Lindsey Buckingham book is only like 100 pages long. There is
That's
not
a pamphlet.
There is not a lot of information about this man available in the wild.
Like, I feel like Christopher Dorner's manifesto is longer than that.
Probably, and it probably shouts out Lindsey Buckingham at some point.
It probably does. I prefer Tusk over Rumors, really.
I'm really looking forward to Hangover 3. And you know, Buckingham is super underrated.
I don't think anybody should sing Green Monolishi but Peter Green.
It's all in there, people. Go read it. We'll link to it in the show notes. Link to the Dorner Manifesto in the show notes. LA Times published it. I think it was them. Anyway, Christine McVie did write a book called Don't Stop, which seemed promising at first, but it's actually a kid's book. So that does absolutely nothing for us.
Can you just color in lines of cocaine? Is it like a...
Probably. So let's talk about Heroes Are Hard to Find. This is the album that followed all of that legal wrangling. They come out the other end and they release the final Bob Welch era album, Heroes Are Hard to Find. Before we get into the music, I just want to warn everyone, back-to-back horrifying album cover era. Mystery to me is somehow the most heartbreaking image of a gorilla eating cake that I've ever seen in my
that's
life.
That's true.
Yeah, Mystery to me is really upsetting.
It's not right.
And this one looks like it looks like Lars von Trier shot this cover. It is body horror shit. It's Mick Fleetwood all gaunt, and he looks like he's a pirate who's been kidnapped. And he's wearing nothing but women's underwear, and his kid is standing on his feet. And it's shot in a mirror, so there's like three different angles. It's horrifying.
What I think it looks like is it looks like an outtake from the Beautiful People music video.
A little bit
from Marilyn Manson. Like it at first look, you don't think like, oh, look at a dad and his kid. You look at like, what is this monster doing to a small person?
Yeah. But fortunately, it is just a dad and his kid. It's ultimately a perfectly harmless image. It just looks terrifying at first.
He looks like an H.R. Giger drawing.
Yeah.
Jesus. It's harmless in terms of what it is. It's harmful when you look at it, though. Like it does things to your mind.
It does psychic damage.
Yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't feel good to look at.
No.
But the album, I personally think, is pretty good.
Yeah, it's good.
It's a very interesting Fleetwood Mac album. The Bob Welch songs sound like he has been hitting the Curtis Mayfield records really hard in recent years, and it is coming through in his music.
I found a Rolling Stone review of this record from like October 24th, 1974, and they're like, it's all right. Bob's nagging nasally vocals are the problem, is what they say.
His contributions to this album are, it's not just that his voice is weird. His lyrics are weird. Mm-hmm. Like the Bermuda Triangle song.
I that's my favorite song on the album.
It's a great song, but it's so very strange.
Lyrically, the whole thesis of that song is, hey, there's weird stuff going on over there. What is it? Who knows? Could be anything. That's it. That's the whole point. I like it when bands do. So I'm a Blue Oyster Cult fan. So like, songs about, you know, cults and UFOs and alien abductions and Nosferatu and Godzilla. Like, that's my bread and butter. So, like, Fleetwood Mac doing a song about the Bermuda Triangle, I love it. It's like if the Beatles did a song about the Loch Ness Monster.
It's a whole lot like that.
That's exactly. I think I could write a song about the Loch Ness Monster.
We're the Beatles. I'm John Lennon. So this song's about spontaneous human combustion.
One day, John came to me and he's like, I think there's a monster that lives in the lake. And I was like, really? I think we could make a song about that. And here it is now.
We're not going to perform the song? All right, that's fine. Yeah, Bob Welch, his songs on this, they're good. Silver Heels is really good. We'll talk about that song later. Yeah. We'll get into that.
Second favorite song on the album.
But his stuff is weird. She's Changing Me. That song just sounds strange in general. It's a very experimental moment in the Fleetwood Mac canon.
Well, the record itself is actually mixed really interestingly. If you're listening on headphones or on like really good speakers, like it does weird stuff, pans left and right. It's cool.
Yeah. Christine McVie, though, on this album, her songs, she's got a couple songs on here that are now some of my favorite Fleetwood Mac songs. The title track is one of her songs.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of sounds like Chicago.
That's what I thought too when I listened to it.
Yeah,
it's a lot of horns, like vintage Chicago, not Karate Kid 2, Peter Cetera, Chicago.
Right. I mean, I still love that song.
Of course. Yeah. Prove Your Love, that has to have been sampled at some point. Like the beginning
of
that.
Yeah.
It sounds like a breakbeat.
Yeah.
A lot of this record has like something that could be like in a PM Dawn album, you know, like it has a.
Yeah. Prove Your Love, especially though. The beginning of that song sounds like a J. Dilla sample or something. But Come a Little Bit Closer, that song, I had never heard that song before.
Me either.
I started researching this. That's one of my favorite Fleetwood Mac songs ever. It reminds me of Bittersweet Symphony a little bit.
Yeah.
Like the drums are so huge and there's all this like orchestra instrumentation. That song fucking rips.
And Mick Jagger gets all of the proceeds from it?
Yeah,
it's like a lot like that.
Yeah, it wrecked their career. It's great. But no, I love that song. It's so good. So good. What did everyone else think of the album?
The album, to me, did have kind of like a soft funk feel to it, which I thought was weird, being that this started off as kind of a blues band. Like, the evolution of this band is very strange.
Yeah.
It's unlike other kind of evolutions that you see. Like, because I guess there's such a kind of turnover and whatever's going on with all of these people involved. Because it's cool, but it does have that kind of, like, pushing towards yacht rock vibe to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. When I was researching this, I don't think I put this part in the notes, but when they're recording Rhiannon, which ends up being one of their biggest hits and the song that kind of blows that first album up, at one point they're recording that and John McVie apparently turned to someone in the studio and was like, you know, we're a blues band, right? And when I saw that, I was like, you heard your last album, right?
That's not a blues album.
Like, that is not That's bluesy amazing. At all.
This sounds nothing like, I mean, not just any of their previous albums, but also, like, especially those first couple.
Yeah.
Like,
this is not a blues album. It's like a Pink and Purple album.
It's in a different part of the record store.
Yeah. I think some of Bob Welch's stuff sounds like Curtis Mayfield a little bit. And Curtis Mayfield was, you know, just huge around this time also. So, I don't know.
I don't disagree with the Rolling Stone review.
The Bob Welch nasally nagging voice thing?
Yeah. And I like nasally nagging voice singers, but some reason it doesn't work for me here.
When I read that review, I was like, I wonder if this record reviewer stuck around long enough to, you know, 20 more years to listen to a Smashing Pumpkins record and how he felt about that.
We should talk about Silver Heels, though.
Yes, can we please talk about the evolution of Silver Heels?
Silver Heels is a Bob Welch's
Green Man Alicia.
Yeah, kind of.
It's a little bit. Yeah, it's a song from Heroes Are Hard to Find. It's a Bob Welch song. And on the album, it's a good song, but it's not, you know, it's nothing remarkable or strange. It's just a solid Bob Welch contribution.
Yeah, it's not like a filler song, but it's not the one that, like, grabs you as, like, oh my God, this is the standout. We got to make this a single kind of vibe.
Yeah.
I'm just different. Just that's how I feel about Silver Heels.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I think it is a very good song.
Yeah.
What's interesting about it, though, is that he rewrote it and re-released it on a 1999 album called Bob Welch Looks at Bop, which I do believe is a slang term for porn.
Oh,
no.
And what else is he looking at?
Well, the album cover, I mean, okay, maybe it's a double meaning, but the album cover, this is the other thing that is, we're going to talk about this album and how strange it is, but like the album cover says it's his tribute to Bebop.
To Bebop, yeah.
And that's like, I don't, what universe?
Is that Bebop?
Is yeah. this song Bebop?
Yeah, see, like, I think he's lying.
He's just lying.
Because he rewrites this song, Silver Heels, except this version on this 1999 album. One, it's called Hustler.
Yep.
Yeah.
Two, it is, I mean, for being the former lead singer of Fleetwood Mac, it is insanely explicit.
Yeah, the explicit stuff is mostly, right, the Snoop Dogg sample and then the feminine sex moaning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which
sex moaning.
Which is, this is 1999.
They were a big power movie.
They were great. Love them.
Donna Summer did the feminine sex moaning in 1975 with Love to Love You Baby, which, by the way, is a very uncomfortable song to hear multiple times in the car with your mother when you're 15 years old.
Oh, but it's such a good song.
It's such a great song. But it was also, it created lots of tense moments of like, I should change the channel, but if I change the channel, it's gonna feel weird. It's gonna feel like I'm making some statement, and my mom probably going through the exact same thing of like, I want to change the channel because this is uncomfortable, but he's 15, and I don't want to create some weird sexual stigma in him. So it's just a lot of both of us listening to that song in silence, being very uncomfortable.
You should have hit the like fast forward button or the next channel button, and then you could maybe listen to Hustler by Welch.
Yeah. I could have switched it over to the, you know, the rock station, and because this was 95, so More Human Than Human by White Zombie might have come on.
There you go.
Also has feminine sex moaning.
Yeah,
sure. Feminine sex moaning. That's the name of this episode.
It should be. The thing I find most surprising about this song is that it came out in 1999. Like, this sounds like somebody who found a keyboard in 83
yes.
and was like, I got an idea. I want to try what the kids are doing. You know, like, it's
what kids
so
were
weird.
Doing this in 1999. This should have sounded like Limp Bizkit if he wanted to do what the kids
No, I'm
were
saying
doing.
Like in yeah, 83. In 83, he wanted to do what the kids were doing. Like, oh, they're playing around with keyboards and samples. I want to try that, you know?
But Welch is so far behind the times that he's doing this, like, at least 10 years after it would have been relevant. Like the album cover itself looks like a punk rock zine cover from like 89.
It looks the album cover looks like it's the logo of a ska band.
Yeah. So weird.
Well, speaking of relevant, there's one more detail about this version of Silver Heels that we have not brought up, which is that in the Hustler version, he name drops Kurt Cobain, but specifically he says getting funky, like Kurt Cobain, because you know how Kurt Cobain loved the funk, right?
he meant to say junk.
getting junky like Kurt Cobain.
It's so weird because he also, he says sing like Paul McCartney, and then he does that really obnoxious old white guy thing where he goes getting funky like Kurt Cobain, and it's like what are you doing? What is
none
this
of, yeah,
on the original version? Doesn't he? It's Etta James. He says. Right?
Shit, the one I heard said Paul McCartney.
Well, no, he says if I could sing like Paul McCartney and get funk, I think he says.
Oh, like Etta James in the original. So, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I believe it's Etta James, but it doesn't come off weird in the original one. In this
it would have been weird if it was Kurt Cobain in the 70s.
Yeah, that would have fucking ruled.
Yeah, that would have been amazing. We're like, oh my God, Bob Welch is a time traveler.
I found this song in the Bermuda Triangle.
What I can't figure out is this just an awkward reference or is he trying to make a sly joke about Kurt Cobain being dead because his body, like, yeah, I mean, well, he was cremated, so he's again, not.
Oh, is he getting funky, like
he's
rotting?
Like he's rotting.
Like he's dying, like he's rot. Because there's a Run DMC song. I think it's King of Rock or Rock Box, one of the two. But at one point they say there's three of us, but we're not the Beatles. And at first you're like, well, there's four Beatles, so that's a sloppy reference. But John Lennon was dead by that point. So is it a sloppy reference or is that a great joke?
Yeah, I don't know. But I just feel like everything Bob is doing here is irrelevant and behind, like way behind. Like the Snoop Dogg sample, the I Want to Be a Motherfucking Hustler, that's just like 6 years after that song.
Well, this is and 5 years after Kurt Cobain
Kurt
died.
Kurt Cobain's been dead for 5 years, and the whole thing sounds like something that was released in the late 80s at the latest. Like it's
Sounds nothing like Paul McCartney and nothing like Kurt Cobain.
Yeah, it really, and it's not bebop at all.
It's
There's
wild.
No bebop in it. And the album cover says the X, letter X.
Yeah.
Fleetwood Mac Mans, all caps, M-A-N, capital Mans, tribute to bebop. And it's like, what is going on here, sir?
Imagine being like a Heroes Are Hard to Find super fan. And you're like, oh my God, it's 1999. Bob Welch has put out a new record. Finally, some more of that soft funk that I love so much. And then this fucking comes on.
Want to be a motherfucking hustler.
And then he goes like, yeah, I do. Or something like that. The background is so stupid.
So weird.
One last detail about this album. The cover says it's his first new work since his 1977 solo album, French Kiss. It, in fact, is not even close. It is, like, he released five other solo albums between those two.
I gotta tell you, between the two Welches we've discussed on this podcast, I prefer Brian Grape Jellyhead Welch. He is the far superior Welch to Bob Welch.
Perhaps they team up. We haven't gotten that far yet, you know? Let's find out.
Bob Welch comes on to Korn Unplugged.
Yeah. What I want to know is, when he was making this particular song, was he like, I am nailing this. Like, this is exactly what the kids want to hear from me.
It's going to be huge. My God.
And then somebody plays Nookie for him and his brain melts out of his ears. Yeah.
I know you've been loving these double heels right here.
Oh, shit. That's what I should have done.
Oh, man. Rest in peace, Bob Welch.
Getting fucking like a Kurt Cobain.
Who else had a shit lyric about Kurt Cobain? Was it like...
Probably Durst.
No, it was like... Didn't like Ice Cube and Dr. Dre do a song together? And it was like, something about trauma might get suicidal like Nirvana. And it was like, fuck you, man. It had just happened. It was like 94. And you're like, what the fuck, guys?
Yeah, I don't know. Sounds like something Ice Cube would do. But yeah, who knows?
Probably shouldn't challenge Ice Cube. I deeply regret doing that.
Yeah, you'll be fine.
Ask him how he feels about the Jewish people.
Yeah. No shit.
So, are we there yet?
Should we get back to Fleetwood Mac?
Yes.
Oh, shit. Sorry.
Sorry. We were getting funky like Kurt Cobain over here. We really went off the rails there. Sorry about that.
This is the point in history where Fleetwood Mac becomes an American band, I would argue. They've resettled in the United States.
Yeah.
Their lead singer is an L.A. musician, and their sound just kind of evolves into that. And there's also this Mick Fleetwood quote from his book. We set out on a tour of the States because our album didn't even chart in England, but we didn't care. Judging by our record sales, our audience had shifted completely to the States, which was fine with us since LA was our new base of operations. We toured nationally and had a great time. It felt like the train was back on the tracks. We made money. We sold out some venues. Everything went smoothly, and we began to feel like a functioning musical entity once more.
Now, just imagine all of that, but as a pirate.
Yes.
Yeah.
All of that, but Mick Fleetwood has one wooden leg.
A functioning musical entity once more.
Yarr.
There, yarr. So if I know anything about Fleetwood Mac, it's that this is sustainable. right? This
smooth
is their,
sailing.
Everything's going great. It's smooth sailing it. From here. Nothing. Yeah. There's nothing could go wrong.
All the turmoil is behind them. Nothing but smooth, placid waters for the rest of the sail.
Yeah.
Except for the part where Bob Welch immediately left the band.
Oh, fuck.
Well,
wait,
okay.
can I guess? Did he take psychedelic drugs and have a psychotic break from reality in the form of a religious epiphany?
You know, it seems like he just hated Christine McVie.
Oh, shit.
And she hated him back. Mm. Like, that's kind of the vibe I get from the various books I've
read. It's got to happen again, though. The drugs and Jesus has to happen again. It's the rule of threes.
I hope so. I hope so. Yeah, he left the band quick. This album was released in September 1974. He left in December 1974.
I mean, when you're done, you're done. You know,
Travis, what month was that Rolling Stone review published?
October 1974. He was like, nasally vocals? Fuck you, Rolling Stone. I'm going to start doing bebop in 20 years.
Done.
25 years from now, you'll rule the day you told me I'm nasally.
And it'll be the first thing I release since 1977.
And yeah, there's not, I mean, the way Mick Fleetwood puts it, it was unexpected, but it wasn't like a very dramatic breakup. He was just like, yeah, I don't want to do this anymore. So now they're living in L.A. The Fleetwoods and the Max are both living in L.A.
Oh, the feuding families reunited.
Yeah, the Hatfields and McCoys of music.
The Capulets and the Montagues.
Are back living in L.A. They want to stay there, but now they don't have a guitar player anymore or
again
a lead singer.
Oh, we didn't get the cool quote about Bob's exit.
Oh, was it that cool? Here we go. This is Mick Fleetwood. Bob's exit wasn't like the others. There was no big blow up, no signs it was coming, no change in his character, and no hard feelings. It was all above board, and to me, all the more a sad goodbye. I knew things weren't great in his personal life, but I was surprised that Bob wanted to leave the fold, because he'd invested so much. His exodus was sudden, and the rest of us were disturbed that he hadn't given us more warning.
There it is. His exodus was sudden.
That's actually a Fred Durst quote, which is weird.
And I can hear it because if you go, his exodus was sudden, and the rest of us were disturbed, he hadn't given us more warning.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, that's an outtake from the $3 Bill Y'all album.
$3 Bebop, y'all.
The Ex-Limp Bizkit Man's tribute to Bebop.
So, as luck would have it, a few weeks before Bob Welch announced he was leaving the band, Mick Fleetwood was at the grocery store. And he runs into an acquaintance at this grocery store near his home in Laurel Canyon.
It's got to be that one grocery store,
it's the country store. Yeah,
the country
store.
Okay.
I think it is. Very interestingly, in his book, says he cannot remember the name of the person he met, which it's only the person who introduces him to the two people that change his life forever. Why would you remember?
Somehow, imagine though, being that guy and reading this book and being like, what the fuck, man?
And what's even weirder is somehow Stevie Nicks remembers his name, because in Gold Dust Woman, they identify him. His name was Thomas Christian, and he was doing PR work for a studio that was opening in L.A. called Sound City. Anyone ever heard of it? There's only entire documentary about it.
Where was that? What was the deal with it?
It was in Los Angeles. And
it was in Van Nuys.
Oh, yeah.
Deep Valley. It's a deep valley. Yeah, Sound City. What did they do there? There was like a, it's famous for a certain record. I can't remember. Never mind. It doesn't matter.
I mean, it's famous for so many records. What one are you talking about? Is it Rumors?
Never mind.
Oh, yeah. Never mind was recorded there. Yeah, the documentary about it's really good.
Fascinating.
We should cover that as a bonus episode. Like, Sound City it's a very famous place. And
it's fucking cool, too, that documentary.
And Fleetwood Mac was in on it kind of right from the beginning. I didn't put all the details in these notes because we might do like a separate episode about Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks, but they were using, like, they were getting to use Sound City for free around
this
time.
Oh my God.
Because they just knew people who worked there and people believed in them enough that they were like, well, yeah, they should be able to record these songs even if they don't have the money to do it. And that's why they were at Sound City so much. They
that's
were just
amazing.
Getting to use it for free.
If you're at all interested in audio stuff and you haven't seen Sound City, one, you should watch it. And two, you should know the name Rupert Neve. It will make a lot of sense to you in terms of like records and stuff that you like. Because he's the dude who made the board that made, well, first of all, the talent made these records sound good, but that board made the talent sound better.
Yeah. And so at the time, Mick Fleetwood was looking for a studio to record in, because after this lawsuit was settled, Warner Brothers was way into Fleetwood Mac again. And they were like, hey, we want to give you a nice advance so you can record an album. They got, I think, a $200,000 advance that went directly into Bob Welch's bank account because no one in the band had green cards or visas.
He's a motherfucking hustler.
And even worse, the reason Mick Fleetwood needed this studio so quick is because the record label was like, well, yeah, we'll give you all this money and we're really supportive of what you're doing, but also we need that album in like 2 months, 3 months.
Oh my God.
Can you do that kind of turnaround? So Mick Fleetwood's like, sure. I just need to find a studio.
And they had just put out Heroes Are Hard to Find. Like, it's not even a year old at this point, yeah. Right?
Not even close to it.
No, it's like a couple months old.
Yeah. And so Mick Fleetwood's like, sure, let me see the studio. And he gets there. He leaves his groceries baking in the car in the hot California sun.
That's how it works.
I mean, the December California sun, but still. Yeah,
still hot.
And he decided he liked the studio well enough and was thinking about how excited he was to bring Bob Welch there to show him. Whoops. When an engineer friend who worked there asked Mick if he wanted to hear something he'd been working on. And Mick said yes. And on the way into the control room, he passes this girl in the hallway. And he was very distracted because she was very attractive. Everyone say it with me. Who was it? Stevie Nicks.
Carol Burnett.
Carol Channing.
For some reason, I was going to say Lily Munster.
Oh, yeah. That would be very distracting.
Rob Zombie.
I like the idea of Carol Channing.
Oh, look, it's Mick Fleetwood.
Zelda Rubinstein.
Well, hello, Mick Fleetwood.
And as coincidence would have it, the songs that this engineer wanted Mick to hear were songs from a young duo called Buckingham Nicks. And Lindsey Buckingham happened to be at the studio at the time doing overdubs. So he comes in and they meet, and Mick was really impressed with what he heard and congratulated this engineer on having worked on this really great record. And was like, all right, me and Bob are going to be back to book some studio time. And then about a week later, Bob Welch quits the band with that $200,000 still in his bank account.
That's amazing. I got to tell you, like, if I'm working a job and they give me that amount of money and I'm quitting, that's just my money.
Kinda.
Like, I'm not giving it to anybody else.
Yeah, I wonder if that was kind of Bob Welch's thinking, where he was like, look, I just did all this to help you fight this lawsuit.
Yeah.
How about you just give me all of your money? It's what Peter Green would want.
No, Peter, I promise I'm going to give this money to Jesus.
Eventually.
And so in a panic, Mick Fleetwood calls that engineer friend and asked about the guitar player from that duo he heard. And he said he was thinking about asking them to join the band. And the response he got was, you should do it. Lindsey is incredible, but he's a teen. His girlfriend, the girl you heard singing with him, is a part of the package. And that is how Mick Fleetwood met Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham.
That's kind of incredible that, like, yeah. I mean, Fleetwood Mac is not, they haven't reached their full power yet, but they are a known entity. You know, Warner Brothers is like, we want a record. They're touring well. People are liking them. And then just some dude noodling around on his little solo project with his girlfriend, and he's like, hey, you want to join this big band now because my other dude quit? That's amazing.
Yeah, they've already had, like, this band has already had like more history to it than like a lot of the bands that I, you know, that are my favorite bands. Like, this is already a band's full story, and then you're asked to be a part of, yeah, I don't know. But they also got lucky too.
Oh, for sure, but yeah. We'll get into it. But
yeah, we'll get, yeah.
It's It's fascinating to me that, like, you always hear the story about, like, oh, it's all who you know. And, you know, success is also, it's not just ability. There's also a certain amount of luck. Like, if this guy whose girlfriend is working as a maid in her free time weren't using this particular studio, what would have happened?
Yeah, a lot of things had to fall into place because Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks had already kind of embarked on their career. Like, the Buckingham Nicks album that they put out is very good. It's It didn't sell that well. It didn't really take off. So they, you know, had reason to want to join Fleetwood Mac. But it wasn't like a instant decision on their part. Like, they had to think it over. And we'll talk about it more. I had a bunch of stuff about their background and how they met. I don't know how much of that we want to get into now, because I think we might do a separate episode about these two in their history.
I do think that would be a good, like, additional episode, like the Buckingham Nicks, you know.
How they met.
The flashback episode.
I will say that after they moved to L.A. together, their career was briefly derailed by Lindsey Buckingham getting mono, which put him under for 9 months. I did not know mono.
Oh, yeah.
Could mono do that. To a
fuck
person.
You up. Yeah.
It only put me out of commission for like a month when I had it, but it was pretty rough.
Sounds intense.
I always think of that Wayne's World joke. Like, I thought I had mono and I was just really bored.
I was really bored.
One really interesting detail about Buckingham Nicks, though, they didn't generally resonate with the public. But for some reason, they were fucking huge in Alabama, specifically Tuscaloosa and Birmingham. They just took off on the radio in those two cities and were selling out arenas.
Well, they did have that song Roll Tide. I think that might have had something to do. Well, Tuscaloosa is where the university is. Maybe a college DJ there. You know who I guarantee has the answer to this? Like,
Rivers?
Knows what this is. Rivers. Rivers Langley, I guarantee if you ask him what this is about, he will go into a 5-minute, like, this is why.
But also, too, I wonder if it's the equivalent of being popular on college radio at this time where not everybody's all connected. You know, like, right now, if you got a big college hit, well, 20 years from this time, if you got a big college hit, you were big across the country. Mm-hmm. This, maybe, it's you're isolated.
Is, this is like... What, 10 years or so before REM got blown up by college radio? So it's maybe it's a college radio thing, but because everything was more disconnected at this point.
I'm sure. They explain why, and it's not that interesting. It's just their albums just sold better there, so they got played on the radio more, and people are like, fuck Buckingham Nicks. And
it just turns out it's local taste. It's like when you go someplace, you're like, fuck, you guys put Tabasco on dessert? And they're like, yeah, man, it's huge here.
But everywhere else, they're doing like LA bar shows, basically. Tiny venues. So yeah, they're not making much money around this time, Buckingham and Nicks. Stevie Nicks worked at a flapper-themed restaurant during this time that we will just go ahead and assume is Flappers in Burbank until Stevie Nicks herself contradicts us.
Well, yeah, Buckingham Nicks was, they're headlining the Burbank Comedy Festival.
Absolutely.
At this point. They were the Garfunkel and Oates of their time.
Yeah, I left that out of the notes too, where... Yeah. In that meeting with Mick Fleetwood, they were like, by the way, can you come to a show at Flappers so we can get up? We got to bring four people.
We're doing the Yoo-Hoo Room on Thursday. And if we could just get the rest of the band to come, I think they'll give us an extra minute of set time.
Bring your percussion vest. That's going to go over real big with this crowd.
And Mick Fleetwood's like, sure, I'll bring myself. I'll bring Christine McVie. I'll bring John McVie. I'll bring Bob Welch. There you go. We got
one more.
Do you
have anybody else? Who's that guy, that Christian guy? Can you bring him?
Oh, man. So eventually they get dropped from their record label. And while Stevie Nicks is serving drinks to open mic comics, Lindsey Buckingham refuses to get a job and just stays focused on writing songs.
Well, why would he get a job? He can eat all the flappy fries he wants.
That's right. He's got the pizza spot.
Yeah.
So around this time, Monday Morning is written. So Afraid. Stevie Nicks writes Rhiannon around this time.
God.
She also wrote Landslide around this time. inspired by an argument with Lindsey Buckingham in Aspen, Colorado, which is where the snow-covered hills line comes from. Sorry, people who thought she was talking about cocaine.
Okay, but it's Aspen in the 70s. It could still be about cocaine.
Yeah, I don't think these things are mutually exclusive. I think there's some Venn diagram of snow and coke.
Well,
here.
It's actually a very weird story. They around this time, Lindsey Buckingham got a job touring with Don Everly from the Everly Brothers.
What?
And the reason he got that job is because it started, I think, as an Everly Brothers tour, and those two had a falling out. So then Lindsey Buckingham steps in for the other Everly brother on a tour put together by Warren Zevon.
What?
And they go out on the road, and Don Everly is pissed that everyone in the crowd wants to hear his old hits as opposed to his new stuff that he's shredding with Lindsey Buckingham, and he just quits the tour and leaves.
Oh,
and
my
Lindsey
God.
Buckingham comes off that tour to Aspen, Colorado, where Stevie Nicks has taken, I believe, a hotel maid job
okay. And
just gets irate with her because this tour has been canceled and now he's got the blues. I'm going to be honest, Lindsey Buckingham seems like he's a bit of a problem around this time.
Yeah, he sounds like a piece of shit.
But if every place Lindsey Buckingham goes, other people start having issues and they leave. Like, Lindsey, you're the problem.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, he's in his 70s now. He was in his 20s when this was all happening. I'm sure he's evolved as a person.
I doubt it highly.
Really?
You made an Everly brother quit. The Everly Brothers.
No, the Everly Brother.
The Everly Brother made the other Everly Brother quit. That was a brotherly
problem.
He was
like, I can't do. I think Buckingham's the problem, man. I'm telling you, he's the linchpin to all of this.
Buckingham replaced one of the Everly Brothers.
I know, but they had encountered him. They knew he was the trouble.
He wasn't there yet.
He's like cursed.
Anyway, Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks get in a fight, and that's why Landslide is written.
God bless that fight then. Jesus.
Yeah.
So what, she wanted him to die in a landslide? Is that why she wrote that song?
Yeah, I don't know. She writes some dense lyrics.
But imagine being that mad at Lindsey Buckingham. You're like, all right, I'm just going to, at least she didn't call it avalanche, which is more accurate if it's supposed to be snow.
And so when they get this call to join the band, despite being highly broke and unsigned, Lindsey Buckingham is hesitant and feels like joining an established band would kind of be a sellout move. And meanwhile, Stevie Nicks feels like eating.
Says the guy who replaced an Everly brother.
I don't get why we're so hung up on him replacing Everly.
Well, but he joined an established band. Like, he's going against his own.
Yeah, but as a touring musician, he didn't join the Everly brothers.
He didn't change his last name to Everly.
Yeah.
He was just I'm Lindsey Everly.
Touring guitar player. This is a quote from Gold Dust Woman, from Stevie Nicks. We were broke and starving. I was cleaning the house of our producer for $50 a week. I come home with my big Hoover vacuum cleaner, my Ajax, my toilet brush, my cleaning shoes on, and Lindsey has managed to have some idiot send him 11 ounces of opiated hash. He and all his friends are in a circle on the floor. They'd been smoking hash for a month. And I don't smoke because of my voice. I'd come home every day and have to step over these bodies. I'm tired and I'm lifting their legs up so I can clean up and empty the ashtrays. End quote. Honest question. Why not just sell that hash? That's a lot of hash.
Yeah. 11. That's an enormous amount of hash.
11 ounces? Because hash, a gram of hash will last you a bit if it's just for PU, which is short for personal use.
That feels like one of those, you know, in the TV show, the big brick they pull out of something, you know, like, oh,
yeah,
they're trafficking, you know, like that's an enormous amount.
It is a comedic amount of hash.
It is a flapper's amount.
And so after a meeting of everyone at a Mexican restaurant in L.A., Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks finally agree to join the band. They are initially paid a salary of $200 per week each.
Well, that's quite a raise for Stevie, going from 50 to 200. You know, it's a 400% raise. Good for her.
It is. And she talks in Gold Dust Woman about this being so much money that she would just like find $100 bills around the house And it's like, it doesn't feel like that's enough money.
$200 is enough money to find that doesn't make sense.
No, it doesn't. But I feel maybe they sold that hash.
Yeah, I think that's what happened.
They forgot to explicate that.
So the turnaround time between these two joining the band and the next album, their first with Fleetwood Mac coming out, is bonkers. They join in very late December 1974, like New Year's Eve.
Yeah. Wow.
December. And that's like holiday time. Nobody's working then.
Yeah.
You know?
And the album is recorded from January to February of 1975 and released in July.
This is mind-blowing to me.
Yeah.
And some of that has to do with Warner Brothers demanding that turnaround. The band, I mentioned it earlier, they agreed to that time frame while Bob Welch was still in the band. So him leaving was a huge problem.
And that's silly. That's silly to me because it's not like they had written enough probably new material. You know, I feel like had Bob Welch not left, they would have been in deep shit with this turnaround time.
Probably, yeah.
Like they would not have, I don't think they would have been able to deliver an album that was as good. I mean, certainly not as good as the White Album, but probably not even as good as the previous album because they just don't have the time to do it. I feel like they got incredibly lucky in getting Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham and the songs that Stevie Nicks had already written.
Oh, yeah. Super lucky. And that's that's another reason they were able to turn it around that fast, is it wasn't so much them joining an established band as it was two established bands kind of merging together.
But oh my God, what they make.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. I don't know why John Courage was so pissed off when Bob Welch left. Bob Welch leaving was good.
Yeah, I don't want to gloss over that detail. John Courage, arguably our favorite member of Fleetwood Mac, when he heard that Bob Welch was leaving, he was so angry, he threw one of Bob Welch's guitar amps out a window. And it's like, I get it, but also, did you check first to see if there are people down there?
Yeah, well, what level?
So he actually did check first, and what happened was it was like skeet shooting, and Steve Earle was outside with a 50 cal waiting for the amp to, he said, pull, yeah. And the amp came flying out the window and he shot it.
And they wrote a song about it called Have Courage.
It is.
It's really about throwing amps out windows.
Yeah.
It is funny that you bring that up because in the Gold Dust Woman book, they talk about this moment when Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham joined the band, and Mick Fleetwood has them over because he feels like he needs to tell them the history of this band up to this point, which is everything we just talked about on the last two episodes. And I bring it up because he adds a interesting tidbit to that story that finally brings guns into the mix in this podcast. Also, apparently, at that point when Peter Green was telling everyone they needed to give up all of their money and give it to charity, he kept getting royalty checks for Black Magic Woman that were showing up at his house. And he was so angry about it, he went to their management company with an air rifle and threatened everyone.
One of the things you got to pump?
Yes.
Yeah.
He showed up with a daisy?
And he almost went to prison for that. Because
he pulled a Christmas story.
Yeah, because not a lot of people are going to recognize that as an air rifle. A lot of people are just going to see.
You'll shoot your royalties out.
Just going to see the Green Man Alishi coming in with a fucking rifle.
Where's Carlos Santana?
Can you imagine the world where a dude shows up with an air rifle and his demand is stop paying me?
Yes.
That's the craziest thing.
That's so great. This is my favorite about Peter Green.
This is bar none my favorite story that has ever come up on this podcast now. This is amazing.
So they decide to spend the month of January rehearsing, and then they go into the studio in February 1975, and it goes really, really well. This is a quote from Christine McVie. This was my first rehearsal.
She's a pirate too.
They were in the band, but I'd never played with them before. I started playing Say That You Love Me, and when I reached the chorus, they started singing with me. I heard this incredible sound, our three voices, and said to myself, is this me singing? I couldn't believe how great this three-voice harmony was. My skin turned to goose flesh, and I wondered how long this feeling was going to last.
If your skin is goose flesh for more than 4 hours, you need to see a doctor.
It's true. I hope she did. But I think she nails it in terms of why this version of Fleetwood Mac is so good. They just sound so good when they sing together.
But it's the last album we listened to. Heroes Are Hard to Find, right? It's a fine record. It's good. There's nothing wrong with it. To know that less than a year later, they made this album, which you listen to and you immediately go, even if you've never heard these songs before, they're immediately going to stick to you. Mm-hmm. Like, they're amazing.
Yeah.
It's interesting because it is like, this is, you know, what a lot of people think of, I think, as the birth of Fleetwood Mac is really more like the comeback of Fleetwood Mac. It's the return of the Mac, if I'm being honest. But it's like they were kind of like, they were sort of doing okay with Heroes Are Hard to Find, but it was like after this long troubled history, and then Buckingham Nicks are having their problems, and then it just kind of, it's the peanut butter and chocolate just comes together.
This is the Reese's Cup of albums, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
If you like that kind of stuff. Yeah. You got your Buckingham in my Fleetwood.
Yeah.
You got your Fleetwood in my Buckingham.
And you only have to hear the first song on this album, which the album is called Fleetwood Mac, but people call it the White Album for various reasons. The cover is white. They did a shit ton of cocaine when they were recording it.
Yep.
The cover is also very Phantasm. You're familiar with the movie Phantasm, it feels like Don Coscarelli borrowed elements from this album cover for his horror movie in some way. It's really weird.
Yeah, but as a sequel to the Heroes Are Hard to Find cover, far less scary.
We finally have started moving towards palatable art.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, everybody. This is Adam, host of the podcast you're listening to right now. Just dropping in to let you know that if you're enjoying this Fleetwood Mac season of You Don't Even Like This Band, but would prefer to hear it without annoying ads like this one, head on over to youdontpod.supercast.com and sign up for the You Don't Even Like This Band Backstage Pass for just $4 a month. Not only do you get ad-free episodes, you get access to an absolute litany of bonus episodes that you can't hear anywhere else. But wait, there's more. Subscribers also already have access to the entirety of the second Fleetwood Mac season of You Don't Even Like This Band. And since we finished that, we've put up a bunch of bonus episodes and we're gearing up to start a new season about a completely different band that you don't even like. There's a lot to listen to, and you can listen to it all for just four little dollars a month. Head to youdontpod.supercast.com and sign up for that or any of our other subscription options and start listening right away. And thanks. We love you. Let's get back to the podcast. The efficiency in the studio probably came down to one more thing that I already mentioned. Here's a quote from Mick Fleetwood. That album was the first time, but far from the last, that we relied on cocaine to fuel the long hours of work. And it's interesting, in the Stevie Nicks book, she kind of says the opposite. She says that cocaine came later, but that at this point they were still kind of too broke. And Mick Fleetwood's like, "Arr, all the cocaine."
We got $200,000 and
who needs money to get cocaine when you've got a crew of the most motley sons of bitches and cutthroats this side of the Pacific?
Arr.
We'll steal our cocaine from Her Majesty.
Those are also all quotes from Mick Fleetwood's book, by the way. Read it. It's wild. He swears that a lot of the tales of Fleetwood Mac excess from at least around this time are exaggerated. The only one he's willing to share is one about how when they were recording this album, he was determined to collect every booze bottle they consumed during the recording sessions.
It's like he's a college freshman.
Yeah. Super duper like he's a college freshman, because about halfway through the recording, the band got collectively embarrassed by the amount of alcohol bottles that were piled up. So they were just like, get it out of here. They didn't stop drinking. They just stopped collecting the bottles. And I will remind everyone, this album was recorded over the course of 2 months.
But Mick, being the responsible one, took it to a recycling place, got enough money, and used that to buy more cocaine.
Exactly.
I love that he's like, oh, this stuff, it's all exaggerated, as he like snorts a line in the shape of a Jolly Roger flag.
And so the album comes out, and the record label was excited, but they were like Nirvana pre-Nevermind excited. If you flash back on that, when that album was about to be released, people were like, man, Nirvana might sell 125,000 albums. Can you believe that? And people were like, shut up. They will not. That's impossible. And in this case, Fleetwood Mac consistently sold around 350,000 copies anytime they put an album out. And Warner Brothers was like, I don't want to get your hopes up. We might sell 400,000 this time. And I bring that up because holy shit, this album has sold like 15 million copies since then.
Well, I think what you're telling me is that before this album came out, things were one way.
Things were one way, Travis. Right.
And then this album comes out.
Right.
And everything changes.
I'm sorry. This moved too fast for me.
Sure.
Can you slow it down to what's step one here?
Well, step one is picture things.
Oh, okay. Hold on. I have some things. Yeah, I got some things. Okay.
But if you could picture all things.
Oh, all. Wow. That might take a minute.
Yeah. In your free time, just kind of catalog all things in your mind.
Oh, sure. Gotcha. And then come back.
And that's how they are. You know, just accept that is how things are.
Gotcha.
This record comes out. Those things are not like that anymore.
What?
Yeah. They're all different.
Too much for me to handle right now. I had things as they were, and now you're telling me that these things are not as they were, but some different way?
Totally different.
Totally. But
fuck,
it didn't happen right away.
Oh,
For one thing, they decided to tour before the album came out, which was a risky proposition because at this point, no one knew even that Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks were joining the band, much less did they know who they were.
They just go to Tuscaloosa and Birmingham.
That comes up in the book. At one point, they had to like delay the tour so those two could go play some sold out shows in Alabama and come back and rejoin Fleetwood Mac, which had to be weird. That had to be so weird. Like, because you're playing a sold out show and you have to kind of feel like, should we just keep pursuing this? Just do our own shit? But too late by then.
Because then you also have all the Alabama, like the Neil Young, Lynyrd Skynyrd at Alabama drama, and then you have Warren Zevon's song, Play It All Night Long, and Warren Zevon put together that Everly Brothers situation with Lindsey Buckingham. So I'm just connecting threads.
So they were
on,
at risk of being
here.
Canceled on social media by Warren Zevon. You're correct.
For sure.
Very risky. And so they decide to embark upon this tour, and it is like their management didn't want them to do it. The record label didn't want them to do it because they were like, nobody knows these two. They're going to be very confused when you go out on the road. But I mean, it's Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham, so it was fucking fine. And I had never thought about that part where they joined that band early. There have to be like videos of like Lindsey Buckingham throwing down on the Green Manalishi and Oh Well. And there are. I found them on YouTube. I'll link to them in the show notes. It's very cool seeing that version of Fleetwood Mac play those songs.
So cool.
Yeah.
First of all, this era of Fleetwood Mac looks like they are made up entirely of people who are in the new Lord of the Rings TV show. Like, Lindsey's hair and beard is just, he looks like a microphone. He's got like a puffy head.
Yeah.
It looks like a little interview microphone. Mick Fleetwood is like long hair, long beard, crazy, gangly, Gandalf looking dude.
He's got a hat too.
Yeah. But then in like one video, he's got an enormous beard. And then clearly they were touring during the summer because he was like, fuck this beard. And then he is like clean shaven in the next video, which they're all pretty close to one another. So, but it's really cool. The Oh Well, that performance, I mean, I swear to God, I think Freddie Mercury saw that and went, I'm going to write Stone Cold Crazy. Because it's almost sounds exact, especially with Buckingham doing it.
Yeah. They go on this tour and it works fine. And then the album comes out and they decide to go on another tour. And this sounds brutal. They release the album in July. They go on tour again in September. And they play 90 shows between September and December.
Oh, my God.
And this is after touring in front of the album's release.
Right.
To try and buzz up, you know, press for the album and or attention for the album.
Like, I feel like we're deep enough into Fleetwood Mac's history that I think it's kind of surprising that they were still touring in station wagons at this point in their history.
That doesn't make sense to me for several reasons, but also, like, if you've ever seen Mick Fleetwood's drum setup, that's not going to fit in a station wagon.
No.
Well, there's a fucking gong. There's a gong.
It's massive. Yeah.
Do the balls ride with him while he's in the car, or do you think
the balls ride shotgun? They have throat seats.
Yeah. He ties him to the trailer hitch.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure.
He's got truck nuts. He's got station wagon nuts.
He's got truck nuts. Yeah. Station wagon nuts. Yeah, it's interesting. The conditions here are so very specific and peculiar. It's a very unique scenario because it's like they've got Warner Brothers. They've got this huge label behind them, but they've also never had a hit in this country.
Right.
And it's been over 5 years since they've had one in England, but they're also not an English band anymore. They're now an American band. And they lose their guitar, their third guitar player that they've lost, and replace him with a singer-songwriting duo that already have had kind of like their attempt. And it's just like a perfect storm of these really bizarre conditions that come together to create this situation.
Yeah. But like, I mean, this tour of just station wagons sounds like, you know, a Fred Durst, you know, fantasy. Like, oh, what if we just toured in station wagons?
Yeah. If you've seen his Instagram, he would fucking
love that.
Maybe
that's why Fred Durst's Instagram is all station wagons.
Could be. He's a big Mac head. I mean,
he was in the Blues Breakers. So
weren't we all?
Yeah.
Yeah, they toured 4 days on, 1 day off.
For 3 months?
For 3 months. And that's hard work, no doubt. But on the bright side, at least every single member of the band was in a crumbling relationship. And the album also wasn't selling that well. So they had all that going for them, at least.
Thank God.
Yeah, Christine and John McVie were very nearly divorced by this point already. Like, those two already hated each other.
Well, she needs to get the perfect back in her name.
Mick Fleetwood and Jenny are having problems again.
Jenny Boyd?
Yeah, but like, when weren't they?
I'm sorry to hear that.
And joining Fleetwood Mac very briefly repair Lindsay and Stevie's relationship, as you know, getting, you know, alleviating your financial stress will do that in a relationship briefly. But
he's not coming back to a hotel in Aspen and yelling at her because an Everly brother doesn't want to tour with him anymore.
Yeah, while she's on her like second maid job
and he's under 11 ounces of hash.
Yeah, but I've already mentioned, seems like Lindsey Buckingham was a little problematic around this point. Apparently around this time, and this is according to the Gold Dust Woman book, don't get mad at me, Fleetwood Mac fans, he started complaining that Stevie Nicks was being, quote, too sexy on stage, and that it made him uncomfortable to see fans fixated on her, and that it reflected badly on him as her man.
Okay, I'm not defending what he's saying here. I'm just saying she was a fucking babe in those, especially that Green Man Alishi footage. It's like, yeah, everyone is in love with her. And I can see him being like jealous of that for sure. But it's still not okay to be a possessive piece of shit about it.
No.
Sure. But is this why she starts wearing all those scarves? Like, oh, I guess I should cover up and make myself look like a scarf monster.
Yeah, could be. He also accused Mick Fleetwood of sleeping with Stevie Nicks around this time.
Well, that's just crazy. That didn't happen.
Yeah, that didn't happen for like another year.
Yeah.
Come on.
I mean, Jesus, if I'm Mick Fleetwood and I'm in a band with like Stevie Nicks in the 70s, I'm sleeping with her.
Yeah.
I mean, if she wants that. I mean, I'm not going to just...
We get it, Travis.
I'm not just going to throw my rhythm on her. You know, I'm going to see if she's into it. You know,
right. Given the opportunity.
Given the opportunity.
You just ask her if she wants to slap your vest.
All right. You want to slap my vest around a little bit, if you know what I'm saying? Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. I'd like to set sail where the sun don't shine.
I might be captain, but I'm not into labels.
So shit was toxic all around. But they did finally figure out how to get the album selling, which I find this fascinating, too. They decided to remix the song Over My Head, which is a Christine McVie song from the album. Fucking classic. Really yeah. good song. But they decided to remix it specifically so it would sound really good on car stereos.
That's
this
cool.
is fucking genius. They moneyballed the radio single.
Yeah.
yeah.
They bring in this guy named Deke Richards, who produced a bunch of hits for the Jacksons. And this is a Mick Fleetwood quote. His version was weighted toward the high end and featured a new guitar introduction and different takes of the vocal harmonies. The result wasn't true to the song as written or played, but I was the first to admit that it sounded fucking hot. When you listen to it on the average system, like a car stereo. We released the single in September of that year, and it was an instant hit. Within a month and a half, we'd sold 400,000 records. That's interesting.
That's yeah. fucking cool. A quick little side note. I've heard stories of around this time, and this makes sense, is certain producers would keep like an alarm clock, like a radio alarm clock in the studio to see how it sounded on that speaker. So they could mix for that. Like, this is how most people are going to hear your music at the time on this kind of shit speaker. So we have to mix for that. So that's really cool that they're like, if we make it sound good on the fucking car radios, make it sound good coming out of shit speakers, you'll sell more records.
So now they have all this money, like the album's selling, they're on tour. The label loves them. Enter Cocaine. Now yes. they can finally really afford it. It becomes a regular feature on tour and in the studio. And it was doled out specifically by who else? John Courage.
Yeah, he threw a brick of cocaine through a window. He was like, you fuckers, here you go.
I was going to say Lily Munster again.
I got to say, when Cocaine finally joined Fleetwood Mac, that's when they became Fleetwood Mac. You know, like Cocaine is really the unsung player of this era.
It Yar, rounds out
who
their
is
sound.
That third? Who is that second guitar player on that demo I heard?
Ah, that's Cocaine.
I'd like to welcome him aboard the ship.
This is a quote from John Courage. The band kept telling me they needed cocaine, and I was afraid they'd get busted in some little town by some derelict coke dealer with a narcotic squad on his heels. I felt my job was to make sure there were no more disasters on the road. I felt protective of them. They were my friends. Sounds exactly like John Courage, goddammit.
Not very courageous of him. I love that he talks like a Jim Thompson novel. What? Derelict coke dealer and the narcotic squad on his heels.
I tell you what I'm going to do. I'm only going to buy coke from vetted coke dealers. I'm going to make sure that we have a nice spreadsheet of people we know are trustworthy coke dealers for my friends. Because I care about them.
He did say that it did eventually catch up to him, but he doesn't give any specifics. Like he could be given these quotes from San Quentin for all I know.
Oh, is Courage joining in the Booker Sugar with all of this? Is he playing along?
I think he meant maybe there were some legal ramifications.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you're talking about how much booze they went through in 2 months, I can only imagine how much cocaine they're going through.
Yeah.
To additionally supplement.
And so,
yeah, well, you know how it is. You have a couple of shots. And then a couple more shots. And then you're like, okay, who's got a key bump for the bathroom? It's like that times 100.
Sure.
So by the end of 1975, they'd sold 1.5 million copies of this album, which is nuts.
Because it came out in July. That's 5 months.
And they ended up doing the same thing with Rhiannon. They remixed Rhiannon so it sounds good on car stereos. And that's what like super duper blows the album.
Oh, yeah. That yeah. song is, yeah.
On the next episode, we're going to talk about a book by the guy who remixed that album. And boy, does he sound like he's got some axes to grind with this band.
Wow.
It's fascinating.
But, I mean,
is that the Deke Richards guy?
No, it's his name's Ken Calais, and he is the father of pop singer Colby Calais, who writes the introduction to the book.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah, it's a book about the recording of Rumors. He ends up being one of the producers on Rumors.
Oh, man.
I just think it's amazing. Look, there's no question that Lindsay and Stevie Nicks are super talented. But to step up to the plate and like write these, bring these songs in a very short amount of time and like to have basically what turns into instant classics. I mean, the record sales support this. That's amazing. Like, that's just kind of unheard of.
And the craziest part, like I mentioned earlier, $200 a week this whole time, this 90 shows in 3 months, all of that touring, $200 a week. And so now that they've sold 1.5 million copies, everyone is like, all right, it's time to renegotiate. Warner Brothers renegotiated with the band and gave them a better royalty deal and a huge advance for the next album. They cared so little about Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks joining the band that they never made them sign what's called a members leaving clause in their contract, which is meant to make it hard for people to leave an established band and go solo.
Plus, they made really great jackets. Members yes. leaving.
And that ends up biting Warner Brothers in the future when those two both decide to leave and go solo. But this is the point where they were officially made members of Fleetwood Mac and were no longer living on a $200 a week salary. This is a quote from Stevie Nicks talking to the New York Times in 2014. I started the year as a waitress and ended it with Lindsey Buckingham and I millionaires. So that's cool.
Wow.
Yeah.
From the Burbank Comedy Festival.
Right? Like, but imagine, like, what a year. Like, you're January 1st, you join Fleetwood Mac, and by December, you've sold 1.5 million albums. Nuts.
And done so much cocaine.
So much coke. Oof.
I love those stories. I mean, you hear that from other bands that we've covered, too, like, oh, we had like a dollar in the bank account and then, you know, Nevermind got released. And then, you know, 6 months later, we had a bunch of money. I don't know. It's just cool to think that like that happens. It feels like an odd cocaine fueled fairy tale.
Yeah. And
yeah, it's weirdly the opposite of the Steve Earle experience. I feel like it's like everything goes right specifically for them to, you know, understand and appreciate it, as opposed to like shooting yourself and your career in the foot at every possible turn.
Yeah, I'm starting to think a lot of success around this time had to do with how well you could handle cocaine. Yeah, because yeah. Everyone was doing it. Everyone. And it just wrecked some lives. And yeah. In other cases, it made rumors.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I imagine like some guy who was, you know, used to do coke maybe with Lindsey Buckingham, or, you know, go to his hash parties, is probably like, yeah, it's cool. You released Rumors. That's great. Let me tell you about my 1975.
I forget what interview I saw, but it was with Mick Fleetwood talking about kind of this era and the change of the band. And it was something about like someone saying, I'm paraphrasing because I don't remember exactly, but essentially it was, this is like miles away from blues. And he went, yeah, but it's a lot closer to the bank.
Yeah.
Like it's essentially, you know, the truck pulled up and took him to a whole different destination and just dumped money on him.
Yeah.
And it's interesting how much of it, I think, comes down to Christine McVie's whole thing too, just about like the harmonies, the harmonizing. Like,
yeah, and the chemistry too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
One of the reasons they had that meeting at the Mexican restaurant was solely to make sure Christine McVie didn't hate Stevie Nicks.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And like those two hit it off right away. And that kind of solidified them as a band. Yeah, Christine McVie's a really underrated figure in this band.
For sure, for sure.
Probably because she quit for like 17 years and then just showed up again in the late 2010s.
Perfect.
But beyond that. So I think that's our episode. Next episode, we're talking about Rumors.
Oh my God.
I feel like that's going to be another four episodes.
That's going to be a couple episodes for sure. That is an album that I think at last count has sold 40 million copies.
Wow.
Or something like that.
I mean, even just this era that we're talking about, when I was listening to the record on the streaming platform that I work for, Rihanna has almost half a billion streams.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
It is a timeless album.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an album where I think there's 11 songs and 10 of them are just stone fucking classics. Yeah. Even if they weren't released as singles.
Yeah, they still become, like, we've moved on. It's one of those albums that, like, we moved on from the singles to find more singles, basically. Like, yeah. After the fact.
And even then, as the album was originally released, I think we might do a bonus episode about this also. There's a song called Silver Springs that wasn't even included on the album. They released it as a B-side to Go Your Own Way, I think. And it's one of their best songs. And it turns into this big fight where Stevie Nicks wants to release it and Mick Fleetwood won't let her because he's going to put it on a box set. And she like leaves the band over it. And when they re-released the album, they put Silver Springs back on it. And it also was released as a single when they did that reunion concert, The Dance.
Oh, yeah.
It was a single then. So, yeah, this, like, there's fucking singles on this album that didn't even make the album. It's insane how good this album is. It's nuts.
It's also insane just, like, being in Fleetwood Mac means you quit Fleetwood Mac. Like,
yeah.
You can't stay in the band.
It's like Menudo.
Yeah, once you age out, you gotta go.
Yeah, it's just that's like 56. At that point, you gotta go. So yeah, we're gonna talk about Rumors probably for a couple episodes. It's a pretty important era in this band's history.
Man, this band, dude, like, I you know, we said it when we started. It's like, even if you casually know Fleetwood Mac, you do not actually know Fleetwood Mac.
No, no.
Yeah, and I didn't even casually know Fleetwood Mac.
And like their albums that come after Rumors are for the most part all really great, but then there's also some weird ones. There's one album that doesn't have Lindsey Buckingham, Stevie Nicks, or Christine McVie on it, and Mick Fleetwood demanded that no one from the band be on the album cover. So the album cover is just a picture of five strangers. One who vaguely looks like Stevie Nicks from a distance. Fucking weird. Very weird.
My last thought on the White Album is it reminds me of, like, if you start watching a TV show and someone goes like, oh, it gets good in like season three. Like, it's one of these, like, the band figured out what the band is with this album.
Yeah.
This is Fleetwood.
Yeah. Well, yeah. The band figured out what the band was. Like, after multiple tours, multiple members leaving, multiple albums released, like, it's...
multiple psychotic breaks.
Yeah. It's like, the band had a whole two bands worth of history before it became the band we know.
I think what this is, at least in large part, is kind of indicative of what record labels used to be like. Like, through all this turmoil, all of this change, all of them, you know, they're selling the same amount. They're not selling more records. They had a major label record deal the whole time. This would never happen now.
Like, oh, yeah. No way.
No.
Like, this band would have been done after two or three albums at best. So something like this probably is not going to happen again ever.
No. I mean, even now, like, you put out a record and it doesn't sell, you're done. That's it. Like, you kind of get one shot at it.
Yeah. It's a crazy story. And we're going to talk about it more on the next album.
I want to be a motherfucking hustler.
Next episode. Travis wants to be a motherfucking hustler. Go listen to the White Album, everybody. It's
got great.
So many good songs.
Yeah.
Look, this has been a fun journey up until this point, but this is really the, like, oh, this is where we've been going the whole time, and now let's do this ride. I like
it. Yeah, it's funny because when we started, I was like, yeah, if it's not Rumors or Tusk, I don't know it, and that's not true, because I knew several songs off of this album, obviously, as well. Like, there are several hits off of this album, off of the White Album, so it's like, shit, even I knew more than I thought I did.
Yeah,
well, that's true of most things, Andy.
Thank you, I think.
Yeah, that was a compliment. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Okay, how sweet.
I've actually been way into listening to Mirage and Tango in the Night, which are the two albums that follow Tusk. Those are both really solid albums.
I don't know those at all, so I'm looking forward to jumping into those.
Tangle, I think I heard a track from one of those on the radio recently and was like, oh shit, this is another Fleetwood Mac song I know that's post-Tusk.
It was probably Big Love. That is the opening song from Tango in the Night, and it's one of Lindsey Buckingham's best songs. When he plays it live, oh, the guitar solos fucking shreds.
Dude,
so good.
Lindsey Buckingham, that dude's an unreal guitar player. I know people kind of, if you're familiar with him, people know that, but like, I think you said it at one point, Adam, like when he quits the band, they have to hire two people to replace him.
Yeah,
like,
both times.
Yeah.
Because he quit after Tango in the Night, and they end up hiring one guy named Rick Vito, and I forget the other guy's name, to replace him. He brings that up in the Behind the Music, the Fleetwood Mac Behind the Music. Lindsey Buckingham is like, yeah, I always thought it was funny they had to hire two people to replace him.
Fred Durst on guitar.
I tried to learn one of his songs once, and I'm like, this is clearly two guitar players. And it was like, nope.
Yeah.
That's just him.
Yeah. If you watch the dance is actually what really got me into Fleetwood Mac. And it's because of the part where Lindsey Buckingham comes out and plays Go Insane and Big Love solo acoustic. It sounds like there are three guitar players on stage, and
it's unreal.
Just him. It's nuts. So, yeah, this is going to be fun. Like, now that we're getting into, like, I fucking love Lindsey Buckingham. I always have.
You want to go see Lindsey Buckingham?
Is he coming anywhere near us? That is the strangest tour I've ever seen.
We could road trip it. Let's road trip it. We could even pick up Andy.
Yeah, pick me up. I'll go see something with you guys.
He's somewhere near, he's in Iowa. I know that.
Wait, for real?
Yeah, I sent you the itinerary. It's the weirdest tour.
It's in our group chat.
It is. There are no major cities.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
The biggest city he's playing is Nashville, Tennessee, but he's also playing Nashville, Indiana. What? Where's that? They have stadiums?
He probably just booked that one thinking it was Tennessee.
Is he playing
and then
a
afterwards
VFW?
They're like, wrong one. Oh, shit. Well, we can't cancel it.
Oh, yeah. Well, you already sold tickets. I might as well play it.
I'm surprised he's not playing Four Seasons Total Landscape.
Oh, my God. I bet you he is.
That would be great. Let's go see him there. That'd be amazing. All right. We should wrap this up. Do we have anything to plug before we get out of here?
I think we're about a month away from my audiobook coming out. So if you want to hear me narrate a pulpy old style radio play that's actually a book about a detective trying to solve a serial killer, that'll be out sometime in October. It's called Stone's Throw, and I am your narrator.
Very nice.
Nice.
Andy?
I don't think I have anything. Look Good for the Boys is coming back in October, and we'll be going through the Halloween series. Some more Ghoul School is coming. I know I say that every time. Every time. But it is. I promise it is. I swear. And I think that's it for right now.
Adam, do you have anything to plug?
Nah, not really. Thanks to everyone that came to the Unpops live show that just happened last week. As we record this, that was very fun. And let's get out of here. Andy, say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Travis, say goodbye.
Our goodbye, matey.
Goodbye, everybody. We love you.